In 6 days, your brother will turn. Will you open the door? The Time We Have is now live on BackerKit, a tragic two-player zombie TTRPG played on opposite sides of a closed door. Inspired by games like For the Queen, this game is contained in an 80-card tarot-sized deck that you can grab right now on our BackerKit campaign. The Time We Have is written and designed by Elliot Davis, with illustrations by Ripley Ash, editing by Samantha Lee, and the theme song you're hearing by Behold. So please head to sadzombiegame.com or search The Time We Have on BackerKit and help us make this game a reality. Thank you. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Aaron Voigt, novelist, tabletop game designer, and video essayist who publishes under A.A. Voigt. His latest project, Détente for the Ravenous, is available now as a game and a novel. Aaron, welcome to the table.
Welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
So good to have you on the show.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this.
So, Aaron, we always like to do a little table setting at the top of the show, kind of go through what this conversation is going to look like. Essentially, we want to get at the crux of your decision to write Détente for the Ravenous as both an RPG and a novel. Why'd you do it? How'd you do it? What does it change about play? And we want to use this to kind of discuss these two wolves inside you, one of which is a novelist, one the other of which is a game designer. Are they fighting? Are they helping each other? What does that look like? If they go to bat, which wolf wins for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the reason to start, you know, the RPG is because I started writing a book. I wrote what would become Détente for the Ravenous, the first draft in 2022. Took me about a year. And then my agent at the time took a look at the first draft and said, maybe you should change it. So I changed it. I don't work with that agent anymore, but I still wanted to publish the book. So I, you know, was like, well, how can I get that book out there? I kind of looked at what I had, which, you know, around the same time I started writing the book, I started my YouTube channel. I was like, I guess I have an audience in RPGs. And I was like, well, there's one way to do this, and it's to make a RPG, which I have done. So that's how that all panned out to varying degrees of success. But yeah, that's how it all got started. You know, and as far as the like two wolves thing, I broadly consider myself much more of a novelist than a game designer. I've been doing the novelist stuff since like 2017, so I guess like 7 years at this point. I'm very new to game design.
Younger wolf.
Yes, a little baby wolf.
When we first learned about this game, seeing it as both being a novel and a game, my first thought was like, oh, that's a little like straight, like that's strange, that's odd, that's interesting. But then I also remembered that I looked over on my shelf and I saw Die RPG right next to the Die comics, and I'm like, actually, it's not that uncommon. It's just when you see Kieran Gillen do it, you're like, oh, of course.
Yeah, listen, I'm not quite Kieran Gillen, but I think, yeah. we're getting there one day. Yeah, I think also Erica Chappell has done a really interesting thing. She wrote Flying Circus and has some like short fiction based in that universe as well. So I'm definitely inspired by her as well.
Hell yeah.
Feels like there is a lot of crossover, which we'll get into, I'm sure. But what I want to talk about is actually what you just mentioned, is that you started this game right around the time you started your YouTube channel, where you do, you know, video essays and TTRPG reviews. And I want to kind of dig into this a little bit and ask you, first off, I think that your reviews are a little different from what we might think of as traditional reviews. How would you describe them?
Yeah, I definitely started at doing traditional reviews, but they got boring. That's not a slam on any of the games that I've covered. It's just for me, doing reviews feels a little formulaic, at least like being like, okay, here is, you know, what the game's about. Here are its main mechanics. How does it incentivize play? How do I think it feels, or who is the audience for this? And that was fine for a bit. But as I started to get a little bit more confident, I felt that it might be something that I could, you know, try to do a twist on. And, you know, the video essay as a format has existed on YouTube for, you know, probably a decade at this point, probably more. And I wanted to try to emulate that kind of style because I think it's a little bit more interesting and hopefully a little bit more appealing to broader audiences. You know, I broadly consider myself a marketer more than a reviewer. I am more interested in getting people to play new games than I am, you know, trying to figure out whether or not a game is quote unquote good. Millions of people every day wake up and decide to play Dungeons and Dragons. And like, I'm sure there are, you know, better games for what they're trying to do for that. No shade mostly to people who play D&D. But like, yeah, I hoped that my this new format of video essays is both, you know, interesting and also can grab people's attention in a different way. And video essays are really, really a way that, you know, it seems like it's helped me connect to an audience. Do you all use YouTube a lot for your actual plays?
We're actually mostly podcast. We cross post to YouTube, but we're not big on YouTube.
Right. Yes, and that's my understanding that a lot of people do that, and I completely understand why. But it's nice to get that you know YouTube audience. But if you use YouTube a lot and like make it your primary platform, like I have had the misfortune of doing, YouTube will, you know, give you metrics, and they kind of really, you know, they tell you exactly, you know, what's going on and how they attract new audiences. And like, that's at the end of the day why I, you know, do YouTube, is because it helps bring in new people. As far as any of the platforms that I've tried to post my work on, YouTube is the best one for that. But yeah, YouTube's a nightmare. But to get back to what you were saying, yeah, I really am trying to copy the styles of folks like Jacob Geller. I'm thinking of Mike Rugnetta, even back in the Idea Channel days.
Sure.
He was recently on a Jacob Geller's podcast, which is why I'm thinking of that.
Love Mike Rugnetta.
Yeah, no, really, really sharp guy. But yeah, I really wanted to start doing more video essay formats because I think that's a different way to get people talking about games.
It's fun because I think I'm pretty sure I found your channel first through the video Antagonistic Design of Morkborg.
Right.
Because I was doing research for our recent interview with Johan Noor. It grabbed me because it reminded me of Every Frame a Painting for movies or Rhystic Studies for Magic the Gathering. I was like, okay, like I recognized this format and I like really enjoyed diving into some of the like very specific things that you were calling out, like the design of Morkborg or the secret lore of Wanderhome, things like that.
I'm connecting back to we recently talked to Quinns, who launched Quinns Quest earlier this year, and we talked to Quinns a lot about how the indie TTRPG scene struggles to create the same kind of community sometimes online that the D&D scene does. And I'm thinking back to like when I first got into D&D, you could find hundreds of video essays on like the lore of Vecna or like some obscure lore thing, or like there was one YouTuber who for a while was doing lore of different monsters, and I used to like eat those kinds of videos up. And I think I love what you're doing here because it's like, let's give this popular video essay treatment to these more indie games. Let's create some awareness with a format people know and love, and that works.
Right, absolutely. And like that's the thing. I mean, y'all are both game designers, and like y'all understand that like you know, the work that we do broadly, you know, if you're a big shot game designer, right, you're maybe reaching five figures numbers of people, right, which, you know, for folks like us, it would probably be, you know, like a dream come true. But for the vast majority of folks in the RPG scene, I think we are working with like, you know, two-digit numbers, you know, one-digit numbers of people who engage with our work. But like, I don't think that makes any of our work less valuable. And, you know, I think that there are some games that like have had, you know, maybe five stars on Itch.io, right? The designer Emily Zhu is one of my favorite game designers. And, you know, I feel like they don't get any like attention, but like I think they're broadly like one of the best game designers out there. I just think it's so important for us to like hype each other up and be like, okay, let's, you know, give that same attention, that like, let's go deep into the lore of this game, because like people are hiding, you know, little tricks and secrets in their work. It's just like you have to take the time to kind of, you know, go through and do that, and you know, it feels so good when somebody looks at a thing you did and points that out and they're like, hey, this is cool. And you're like, that's right, it was cool. I did that on purpose. And I just, yeah, I that's what I'm trying to do with my work, is just hype up like smaller creators, because like, it's hard out there.
It's hard out here.
It was a real joy to go through your videos and just kind of like browsing through the titles that you've done. And, you know, you'll see Wanderhome and you'll see Morkborg, which are still very indie games, but the high end of the indie game sphere. but then also see Venezia Valetti's Blood Beam Badlands there. I'm like, ooh, I didn't expect that. Let's watch that.
Yeah, no, Vidic is great. I've actually had the privilege of playing with him a couple of times. He's a hilarious person, yeah. But also, you know, just a great game designer. He was up for a Dicebreaker, you know, rest in peace, you know, award, and that's how I found his work. And then I saw a picture of a Tyrannosaurus with a gun for a head. I was like, I need to cover this today. And yeah, no, again, another designer that I think should get much more credit because Vidic is a genius.
So true. So
absolutely.
True. It's funny because we were talking about prepping for this interview, how like there's a lot of crossover between kind of like what you do and what we do, where it's like we try to, you know, take indie games and give them the professional actual play treatment. You're taking indie games, giving them the video essay treatment. How do you just kind of largely go about picking the games you want to cover?
Great question. It's not easy. A lot of the times it is just like, I mean, I have a big spreadsheet, which is like, okay, I think I can make, you know, 20 videos this year. You know, let's see if I can, you know, hit these topics. I try to devote a certain portion of my videos to designers who are Asian or from the Asian diaspora. So I'm like, okay, let me try to, you know, say, you know, if I'm covering, you know, 20, you know, games this year, I'm going to try to make 10 of them about Asian designers or from Asian designers. So I, you know, narrow down my searches like that. And then I just, you know, kind of have to read broadly and, you know, look around. And I mean, a lot of it's luck. And that's, I think that's one of the harder parts of, you know, this is a hobby, is, you know, looking through games and being like, I wish I had something interesting to say about this game. Like, even for games that I broadly think are good and I like, sometimes I just don't have an angle on them. There's just some games where it's like, I don't have anything interesting to say about this. I think they're, you know, I think it's, you know, a completely solid piece of work, but like, I need something interesting to do a video essay on. I need like a little handhold.
Right. Sometimes the appeal's right on the tin for a game.
Right. Absolutely. But yeah, you know, a lot of it is there's a Mint over at on Tumblr has a there's a TTRPG for that blog. I don't know how plugged y'all are into the Tumblr scene, but it's still there. The Tumblr tabletop scene is alive and well. So Mint does a great job over there. But yeah, you know, sometimes it's just itch.io bundles. Sometimes it's just like going through folks' self promo. But as I'm sure you all are aware, word of mouth is king. If somebody is like, hey, you would love this game, you know, that's going to do it for me more than anything else, I think.
In the realm of word of mouth, any games that you've found recently that you think you'd want to highlight real quick?
Oh, let me pull up my spreadsheet. Oh boy. What's a super weird one?
I like the impulse to go to super weird. Rather, I mean, you're not looking for good, you're looking for weird.
That's why itch.io rules, though, right? It's because they're not.
No, I agree.
The stuff on itch.io is like not necessarily polished or, you know, even complete. Like half the times it's just like a fragment. It's like a Word document. But like that's the stuff that I think is really, really great. I have a whole thing of stuff that I want to cover. I mean, actually, not to flatter you, Elliot, but I was like looking through this before. I was like, I should probably do some research on these folks' work. And I found Journey of 1000 Zips.
Yeah.
And I was like,
no, flatter me with that. I'll take that.
I was like, this is prime video essay material. I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking, have you heard of Click Holding? That game?
Yes. Yes.
I was like, this is the same. So I'm not going to promise anything.
No, you don't have to, but I just love that you found it and you were excited about it. Yeah. That rules. Cause I love Journey of 1000 Zips.
Yeah. This is incredible. Just like, yeah, there's 1,000 nested zip files. That's a tabletop game. Sure. Yeah.
Allegedly.
we'll find out that might be a click hold. I might do a video on comparing that to click holding if I find the time, because that's, I love the idea of like a repetitive, like going through the motions, being like, okay, I have to do a tedious thing a lot. And like what kind of game emerges from that? So that is something I added like minutes ago. There's also a game I saw a couple days ago, Helvetia, by Bully Pulpit Games. You know, those folks who did Fiasco, I believe. Quote, Helvetia is a three-player game about the palace coup that took place at the Helvetia Milk Condensing Company in 1907. When one of the three founders is forced out, there's a vicious but very genteel scramble for power among the three people who hold the most stock.
Whoa.
What? And like, I think it was promoted as like, oh, here's the quote. I set out to make a short LARP about the most boring thing I could think of, which is an incredible pitch. And I was like, okay, yeah, I want to look into that. How do you make the most boring LARP imaginable? You know, what does that look like? And that's why I think stuff on itch.io is so cool, because you could just throw a file up there and hopefully that produces something interesting. And like, that's so great.
That rules.
I hope that answered that question. That oh, yeah. took longer than I
we'll
wanted.
Link, we'll link those in the show notes for sure. Any excuse for me to link 1,000 zips in the show notes?
Please.
the link for 1,000 zips will be 1,000 nested links.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. Good.
Oh, don't tempt me. So Aaron, I think that transitioning kind of from video essay into your writing work, I think that doing these video essays it's a lot of writing and it's a lot of reading. And I'm curious kind of what are the biggest things you have learned from this process and applied to your work as first a game designer? Let's go there.
I mean, I think for, you know, what I've learned, what I've taken from writing and put into game design, a lot of it is just like sometimes you have to sit down and bang it out. Like, you know, obviously that doesn't work for everyone, but for me, it's just like I have my little forest app. I click the button that says 30 minutes and then I, you know, prevent myself from going on social media for 30 minutes and I sit in front of a Word doc until something happens, and then I take a 5-minute break and then I do it again for 30 minutes and then I say, that's my writing. Right, yes,
Pomodoro. I've literally got my Pomodoro you got counter it, right? right here.
Right. That's the only way I can get anything done. And I also just devote like 1 hour of it, you know, to that work a day. I think if I can write an hour a day, you know, for not even every day, but like 5 or 6 days a week, I can get a lot out of that. Detente for the Ravenous is a first, you know, version was 100,000 words. I cut it back to about 80,000 in the second draft, but that's still a lot of writing, you know, and between, you know, game designs and work and, you know, video essay writing, I typically average about 100,000 words a year. So like it's just forcing myself to make the time for it at the end of the day, which is not a sexy or cool answer, but it is unfortunately just the only way I can make stuff.
The real answers are rarely sexy or cool.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
Shit is rarely cool.
No.
Well, so I think I want to get into, or like that's a great transition into, let's talk about, you know, we're a games podcast first, so let's start first with the game. Tell me the pitch for Detente for the Ravenous, the TTRPG.
Detente for the Ravenous is a resistance system game where you and a group of KGB-inspired agents will try to destroy the theocratic empire that is trying to take over the world. The very short pitch is you and a group of your teammates are trying to assassinate Pope Henry Kissinger for his Catholic kaiju attacks on your countries.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That slaps.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I like about the indie RPG scene is you can just do stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you find a sentence like that in indie RPGs, you're on the right track. So kind of related to this, who would you kind of say this game is for? Like, who's your, like, ideal player?
So, I mean, I think it's definitely people who are into, you know, Heart and Spire, right? Heart and Spire are obviously the main games that I drew from this, especially Spire. I really got into the resistance system when I did my long like lore video about Spire, comparing it to R.F. Kuang's Babel and Arcane History, and like how, you know, the dark elves in that society are also doing the work of bringing down empires in the same way that the protagonists of Babel are. You know, so definitely people who are interested in the resistance system, but also people who are like Cold War sickos, like who are into spycraft and all that. I did a lot of like reading about, you know, the various coups that the United States threw from the 50s through the, you know, 80s, which unfortunately does not encompass the entirety of the coups the United States has done. Whoops. But like, so that's definitely a touchstone. Also, if you are interested in the 17th century, specifically the 30 Years' War, that like 1618 to 1648 period.
Sure.
You know, I didn't do as much research into that, but, you know, I think the like style of warfare is very evocative, where you just have like big blocks of people with pikes, but you also have like horrible like 17th century firearms that like are, you know, they technically work, but they're also like halfway burn your fingers off if you shoot bad. There's people fighting with, you know, big great swords, Zweihanders. There's people who are running up with little swords. Like it's just a wild era of military technology. Those big ugly star forts that are so imposing yet like, you know, effective as opposed to a squared fort. So yeah, like anybody who's interested in that sort of thing, I think you'll find a lot to like in this. You know, like I truly think this audience is very narrow. I think that this is, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the concept of making art for 30 sickos. And like that's, I don't think this is going to appeal to everyone, but I think there is a very small group of people who'll be like, oh, this is my shit.
I know I was very influenced by... Oh, and now I'm going to forget the person who wrote it. But there's someone who wrote the idea of like the thousand fans theory. And this was really big in like the early aughts. And it's still kind of, it's kind of what Patreon was based around. And the idea that like, if you can have 1,000 people who are like gung-ho about your stuff, who are like, you are their number one thing, that's enough to make a living. And it's like a really great way to make art and to make things. And this has like a touch of that in a way that I really love.
Absolutely. I'm lucky that I do not have to, you know, do this for a living. This is still like just my hobby. I have a pretty chill job that I'm grateful to have. But yeah, you know, I think I do think that it would be very nice if we could all just like, you know, 1,000 fans seems right though. You know, it seems like that's the right number of people. I know I personally like am probably not going to get to that number, but I think I can, you know, I like the idea that like if you can be the dude or the person for, you know, a small number of people, that's like, okay, whatever that person makes, I am down for it. I'm going to be behind them. Like that's something that I think is really interesting and important, and like why indie RPGs are fascinating, because I guarantee that like for you know, there's like a dozen designers that none of us have ever heard of that like is that person for someone.
Totally.
It is a real sense of community that I think we kind of forget about sometimes when you're in the rush to create things, because you're trying to make sure that you can, you know, get enough money to make more of them and subsist and you know, and you live. And I think there's always that element of, I don't know, coming from social media, you like seeing the numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right.
But there is something really beautiful about
big number good.
Big number equal good, bad low number equal bad.
And that's the thing I hate about YouTube so much, is that it gives you little stats that like every 28 days it like kind of updates your stats. So like if you did good, it'll give you a little green arrow. And if you did on average, it'll give you a little green check mark. But if you did bad, it'll give you a gray arrow and that pointing down. And then it knows that it's disappointed in you. And it's like, I don't give a fuck about you, YouTube. Why? Right. Why are you doing this to me? You don't know me like that, but it still gets in there and it sucks.
Is your video a 1 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10?
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. I hate that so much.
But it is nice to kind of divorce some of creation from the necessity of looking for huge numbers and just be like, let's find my people. Let's find who that group is, and then just like continue making something for that group in a way that like, if you got 50 people in a crowd at a comedy show, that's a pretty big comedy show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's easy to forget that when you see, you know, a TikTok with 10 million views. It's like, yeah, that is a different thing.
100%. I just want to bring up this manifesto that I've been trying to hype up by Domino Club on Itch.io. It's called Good Writers Are Perverts. And I
links like, in the show notes.
Yes, I will send you all the link, because it's a great little manifesto. It takes about 5 minutes to read. But basically, it starts by saying that, like, I think that a lot of small indie games have this sort of, quote, spot the author's fetish element, end quote, that it tends to be A, subject matter, and B, the element of the game that is most comprehensively lovingly made with everything else in support, a game with bare bones images and music, but with engaging gameplay, a gorgeous UI supported with merely functional plot and mechanics, intricate, mysterious world building with stolen music and plain art. And then it like keeps going and basically says that like, I think when writers are afraid to be perverts, that they make bad work. They make the work that can't stand by itself, collapsing on interrogation or challenge. or too many contrasting and unconfident voices have averaged out to a sort of perversion of the commons, indulging only the safest and most unoffensive fetishes to render on the screen. And like, you know, the whole essay is great, but like, it does make me think that like, yeah, I think we should all try to make our art a little bit, you know, weirder and a little bit more niche, because like, I think that's the thing that makes it, that's why we get into this in the first place, to be like, I like this thing. I don't think any of us, you know, got into this to be like, I want to make stuff for, you know, that appeals to the broadest number of people. You know, maybe we end up there by necessity, which, you know, I don't blame anybody for, but like, I do, that's, the Taunt for the Ravenous is purely like a vanity project in a way that I am like very grateful to be able to make.
There are very few people who are just going bananas for vanilla ice cream. But a lot of people are like, man, let me tell you about this taro ice cream I tried this one time.
Brian is that person wanting to tell you about the taro ice cream he tried this one time.
Taro ice cream at Chinatown Ice Cream Factory is the best ice cream there. Second is Zen Nut Butter. Please go check it out.
Right. But like, that's ice cream is going to stick with you forever, right? Because you can get vanilla anywhere, but you can't get taro anywhere. And like that elusive quality, I think, is really important to be like, oh, man, I had a really weird ice cream that one time and it changed my life and I can't get back there. I guess you can get that back there because it's a physical location, which is great.
I used to work on cooking television shows. And on one episode of a show, they were doing a game where they had to rank the hotness of peppers. But the game was, we had infused ice cream with the peppers and they had to like eat a bite of ice cream and then figure out what pepper was which. And we had an ice cream that was ghost pepper ice cream. So like super, super crazy hot pepper in ice cream. And it was the most insane culinary experience I've ever experienced in my entire life. Because you take a scoop, it looks like vanilla ice cream, you put it in your mouth, and it's cold, and it tastes a little bit like vanilla ice cream, and then your mouth explodes. And then you, for a moment, are like, why did I do this? This is going to ruin my day. This is bad, 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 bad. And then the milk of the ice cream cools down the heat, and then you just get a nice little tingle, and the taste of ghost pepper, which is actually quite good. And that I tell that story probably once a month, and I had that ice cream one time. And oh, I'm pretty sure in my life I will have it one time.
And all of 20 people ate it.
Yeah,
I've been getting into hot ones a lot recently, and like, that is incredible. I want that ice cream now. That sounds
it
like
was so good.
Yeah, that sounds like such a good experience.
It was wild. So, you know, yeah. I have an ice cream maker. I should just do it.
You should try it.
Do
bro.
It.
I really yeah. should. I like ice cream all the time.
Just don't overdo it, or you'll have to go to the hospital.
Yeah, make the ghost pepper ice cream, and writers, make the ghost pepper ice cream game. That's the takeaway here.
Exactly. A Fool's Errand is a tarot-fueled science fantasy game set in a post-calamity world of androids, humans, and all those in between. Build your fools and explore realms both waking and subconscious. But the more powerful you get, the more the major arcana gods will take notice and rain down their love and rage as both boons and calamities. Every calamity dreams its successor. The world approaches its next big oops. So, fool, will you deny these jealous gods? Back A Fool's Errand right now by visiting www.afoolserrandgame.com. Your errand awaits.
Hey there, it's Elliot from the Many Sided Media team. In addition to playing and producing here on My First Dungeon, I'm also a game designer, known for such games as Something Is Wrong with the Chickens, a rules-like game of chickens, eldritch horror, and revenge. Project Echo, a solo time travel game played in the pages of a planner. And the upcoming Rom-Com Drama Bomb, a three-player game of meet cutes and mayhem. If you like weird and unique games and want to bring something new to your table, head to moreblueberries.shop and use code MYFIRSTDUNGEON for 20% off your order. That's MOREBLUEBERRIES.shop. Thanks! little bit more stuff I want to talk about in the game itself. Like, I love the resistance system. I'm a huge fan of Heart. I've played Spire a little bit less, but I just go bananas for Heart. Why was this the right fit? Why was this, like, thematically the right mechanic for the kinds of stories you're letting people tell with this game?
So I definitely, like, wanted to explore different systems, but I think it just came down to Spire is already a game about, like, revolutionary violence, which Détente for the Ravenous, the novel, absolutely was. So when I was adapting the novel into the game, I was like, okay, that kind of makes sense. And I also just like how it's got that built in, like, okay, you know, you can take blood stress or whatever, but you could also take, like, shadow stress or mind stress, or it's not called social stress, but, like, you know, the stress that, like, indicates, you know, your standing with other people, like in your criminal gangs or whatever. And I really like that idea. You know, I think that's one of the reasons I initially wanted to start getting away from D&D is because it has no way to really, like, mechanize social consequences. And I really like the fallouts that you can get, you know, if you're trying to mechanize social consequences, to be like, oh yeah, you know, you made, you know, an enemy of the wrong group, and now you are shunned, and, like, you can't buy stuff somewhere, or, like, you're getting followed now because, like, you pissed off the mafia or something. So that's why the resistance system worked. Just, like, it just fit perfectly. I had also just done two very long video essays about Heart and Spire, so I think it was also just on my mind. I was like, yeah, this will probably work.
It's a cool system. I'm curious, what's your favorite fallout that you've written for Détente?
The name Ravenous comes from the fact that there's, like, the Catholic kaiju. So one of the worst ones is where you get turned into a Catholic kaiju and you lose control of your character and you probably kill everybody in your team on accident. So that's great.
All right. It feels like we have to take a small pause and really dig into the phrase Catholic kaiju.
Oh, word.
I don't know if we can continue on before we fully understand the phrase Catholic kaiju.
I thought it was self-explanatory. Were either of you raised Catholic?
I was raised Catholic, yeah.
I'm sorry.
I know. It's a real bummer.
What's your confirmation name?
I was baptized, but I was never confirmed.
Okay, all right. You got lucky. Congratulations.
My priest explained to me that confirmation, like, you've got to promise to raise your child in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't think I can promise that at the age 13.
Yeah.
My parents were very impressed with me, and I think my grandmother was a little bit disappointed.
See, you're wiser than me, because I guess my kids are still obligated to be Catholic.
Yeah, you're trash, man.
I'm screwed. That'll be an awkward conversation. But yeah, so... if you couldn't tell by the title, it's a bit of a pretentious novel and game, right? The metaphor for the Ravenous, right? The Catholic kaiju. I wanted it to be like a way that, you know, to one, I just like big monsters. I think they're neat. But like, I wanted to talk about the ways in which, like, you know, religion can both make people into monsters. Specifically, I'm thinking about the ways that, like, the Catholic Church has been weirdly pro civil rights vis-a-vis biracial and the mixed marriages as far as race goes. I'm a biracial person, so, like, that's been important to me, you know, growing up. My parents were both Catholic but from different parts of the world, but then, like, have not been so chill about gay rights, which I, you know, couldn't square super good, and eventually was the main reason I'm no longer Catholic. But, like, so, like, that in that way, right, religion tells you that somebody's behavior is monstrous, right? But then also the ways in which, like, we are turned into monsters by the state that we live in, right? I think are you all based in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So I'm based in, you know, Illinois. So we all pay taxes to the United States government, which does make us in a teensy little bit. We're all a little bit murderers, which I don't love. If I'm being completely honest, I'm not thrilled about that. I wish that that were not the case. And, like, you know, I don't think most of us probably did not opt into that. We didn't, you know, when we were born, sign something that was like, I'm actually cool if, like, you know, 10% of my, actually, it's probably closer to like 30% of my income is going to be used for, like, explosives. I think there's always going to be conflict in the world, but, like, I don't love that I am going to be directly responsible or indirectly responsible for, you know, a state that wants to shape that conflict to its own ends. And you know, in the results, you know, hurt a lot of people. And that's, you know, that's when I'm talking about the coups, right? That's just been the United States' foreign policy for 100 years.
So are the Catholic kaiju, like, taking that, like, forced complicity and actually turning the equivalent in the story into actual monsters?
Yes, yeah. You know, it's like, I guess it started with, like, I think that there's always going to be, you know, some form of, like, crime or conflict, right? I think that, you know, people are always going to have differences because, you know, people are messy. But, like, when you mechanize that and, you know, codify that with religion and with law, then you are trying, you are turning it into a system that can be exploited, right? So I guess the idea was that, like, people in this world, you know, just will, for random reasons, turn into big monsters, right? Because, you know, that's my metaphor for conflict or crime or whatever. Why the things that people do that are kind of bad, you know, unpleasant. But, like, when you frame that in a way and you try to make rules around the way that people are monsters, and you try to turn that into something you can exploit for, you know, in the United States, where we have a prison industrial complex that profits off of the labor of people who are considered monstrous. That's, I don't like that very much.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, and this is the case, and I feel like with a lot of, like, TTRPGs. I mean, you mentioned Spire as one of them, of, like, playing with monstrous real world things, you know, in a game.
I think it's probably fair to say that, like, it's hard to trust that people will do the right thing with your games. You know, you can put safety tools in, you can kind of put your intentions in there, which I have. You know, I don't know how more clear I could be that, you know, there's a certain bad guy than putting Henry Kissinger's picture in there and putting making him high value target number one.
I don't know. It could be anyone, really. we're going to dig into it in the next half hour.
Sure. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's just like you have to, you know, put your intentions on the page and, you know, trust that GMs will understand your intention and, you know, treat it with respect. At the end of the day, like, if that comes through, then, you know, I've done my job.
Hell yeah. I think it's finally time to turn to Détente the Ravenous, the novel. Can you give us the pitch for the novel, and then we can kind of, like, go through... I want to learn a bit more about the novel, but also, like, how it became this game as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the pitch for the novel is much the same as the game. There is a young woman, Julia Arbit, who is essentially a priest in an island nation that has been, you know, that is... had religious influence. The Catholicism stand-in in the novel is called the commune, but, you know, her country becomes a casualty in the greater war going on between, you know, Kajum, the big Rome Vatican America stand-in, and Gada, which is the, like, Soviet Union / Parthian Empire stand-in. It's weird. And she decides to take revenge on the head of her church, who is Pope Henry Kissinger, and goes to Kajum to take revenge, and, you know, tries to figure out what her, you know, complicity is, you know, being a priest in this system, trying to understand that. But also, her ex-girlfriend, KGB agent, showed up, and, you know, she has messy feelings about that. And they also have to fight a bunch of horrible monsters.
And then for both the book and the game, was the book entirely written before the game was written?
So yes and no. I never planned to turn the game or the book into a game until after the book had been, like, completely written. But as I was, like, getting my, you know, feedback from folks, my beta readers, and trying to figure out, like, if I should just abandon the book or put it out there as a self-pub thing, I started realizing, like, okay, well, let me just try to make a short game that I can, like, use as a marketing scheme to get people interested in the book. That got out of hand, unfortunately.
Yeah, short is not what I see in the
250 some pages or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
you
the
made
novel,
a game.
The novel's 80,000. The novel's 80,000 words, and the book is 50,000 or. Yes, the RPG is 50,000, which it was a mistake. I didn't want to do that, but it happened. But, like, when I'm – because, you know, I only ever plan to release these digitally, I could just kind of make adjustments to the book as I was writing the game. So there's a class in the game, the bioengineer, which is like a evil scientist type who... The word bioengineer didn't appear in the novel at all in the first and second drafts of it. But as I was writing the game, I was like, oh, you know, there's like this weird science, right? The science that makes the Ravenous, that's bioengineering. And I, you know, took the concept of the bioengineer from the game and put it back into the novel. And that way the novel did get influenced by the game a lot, which I think is cool. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, okay, I guess these two, you know, pieces of work can actually talk to each other in a fun way.
I do want to call out the earlier in this interview, you said, oh, I'm just trying to sit down and write whenever I can, an hour at a time. And somehow you still accidentally came up with a 50,000 word game.
So, yeah.
It's an accident. It could happen to anyone.
It's an accident. It's just like you tripped and fell? What?
So like when you write a book, you have all these like, you know, all this like lore stuff that like, I had all these ideas that like just didn't make it into the book. 'Cause it's like, I don't really need to explain the like backstory of the, you know, the Russia stand-in. I think they're cool, but like that is, I need to talk about my like pseudo, you know, Karl Marx figures really. I can make reference to him, but like he doesn't really show up. But like then I had the opportunity to be like, okay, well, let me expand this. And Heart and Spire both have a lot of, you know, lore like in their like latter halves. And I was like, okay, you know, lore is, I think you all probably have thoughts on this. I mean, I don't know how many of you have played a game that was like, I have to stay strictly to the lore. I can't make any deviations. Like, I probably don't think people are going to use it, but I think it is an interesting scaffold, right? What is J. Dragon's playground theory, right? The rules are the skeleton for play, right? In the same way, you know, the lore is like the skeleton for play. It helps outline the world of the game and, you know, give you something to work with. So that's why... You know, a lot of those words sort of happened because I was, you know, you try to copy. You should also, this is just a lesson to everyone, don't try to copy Grant Howitt and Chris Taylor because they're on another
level. They're verbose.
They're verbose. Yeah. It's funny, you brought up J. Dragon, and I'm reminded of when we talked to Jay, we talked about this idea about how RPGs are one half of a conversation. You are starting the conversation and you are letting players finish it. And a novel is kind of both halves of that conversation. And so I'm kind of curious how you see, will players of your game, if they read the novel, have a distinctly different experience having kind of had both halves of this conversation?
I think they will. I think they'll see like, oh, yeah. This definitely came first because many of the classes of the book are based directly off of characters in the novel. They'll be like, okay, yeah, this is clearly the agent is clearly Serith, right? There's abilities that are in the game that just like sort of happen in the novel. They'll see like brief references to the Ravenous, and they can look at the stat blocks and be like, oh, this guy wrote a whole stat block for this monster that like, you know, you can, you know, see how it plays out in the novel and then compare it to the game and be like, oh, okay, so that's why he gave it 200, you know, resistance, because it's not intended to be killed. Because in the novel, it's like, oh yeah, I can't kill this thing.
Sorry, 200, there is something with 200 resistance?
216, baby!
What is this?
It's the Seraph. It's like the big, you know, monster that gets revealed at the end of Act 1. Spoilers for my own book, I guess. Like, you know, it's revealed that, you know, not only are the Ravenous, you know, being used, but they've also created a super Ravenous, right? because of course they did. And the Seraph is the super Ravenous that is, you know, going to be deployed. And that's the reason why it stops becoming just an assassinate Henry Kissinger story, but also like, now we have to stop, you know, this big monster from being deployed story. And that's how the Seraph shows up. And it's a big goat monster thing.
For someone who's less familiar with Heart, 216 resistance. What's a regular resistance number?
I think
it's down 15. In the like, yeah, in the in between 10 and 20.
They tell you in the SRD that like you should expect to do about 4 like resistance points every time you succeed in an attack. So I don't really expect people to kill it. You could, I'm sure you could, right? You know, that's the thing about games. I'm sure there's a way you could engineer a scenario where you could bring this thing down. But like when you
challenge accepted.
There was There was an episode of Dice Exploder where Sam Dunnewalt was talking to a guest, and they bring up the D&D like prestige classes, and how they were talking about how, like, yeah, you're probably never going to be a Death Knight in D&D because, like, it takes like too much real world time to build up to that level. But it's interesting to have in your book because it's like, okay, that tells me something about the world. And I think it's very fun to be like, oh, there's a monster with 200 resistance in this game. Like, probably not feasible to destroy, but like, it's very fun to threaten your players with that monster and be like, okay, so if this exists in the world, how do we deal with it, you know? And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the central question of the novel, is like, how do you kill something that's not really killable?
All right, so we do a West Marches style campaign, and it's just, we just play different groups throwing themselves at this thing until it's dead,
and we just see how many people we've got to bring in before we kill it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, a funnel. Yeah, no, hold on. I'm writing a prequel as we speak. I'll see you all in 3 more years.
And it'll be just a cool 100-page prequel.
Something easy.
Cool. Something easy. Cool.
Actually, that's a pretty good segue into a question we wanted to ask of, you know, games have supplements, novels have sequels. Are there any plans that you have to expand the world of Détente the Ravenous at this point?
You know, it depends. I think probably not. You know, obviously, like, it depends if people like really, really into it, then I'll absolutely consider it. But, you know, right now I think I'm probably going to take a little bit of a break and then work on another book, and we'll see where that goes. I think, you know, it really just comes down to feedback, right? Like, if I get like 10 people being like, actually, I would like a sequel to this, please, I'll be like, yeah, maybe. It all depends on time. But at the end of the day, it kind of comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. Like, people need to have feedback and positive reinforcement and be told that they're great. So if y'all could just flood my comments and give me 5 stars, et cetera, make my head very big, and then you can get a sequel.
Hell yeah. So kind of bringing us towards the end here, I have a fun question I hope that you're down to do.
Sure.
If you were to make a video on your own game, what aspect of it would you dive into? And if you're feeling so bold, what would you title the video?
Oh, God.
We do games on this podcast.
I mean, unfortunately, I think it'd be very similar to something I did with Kevin Tian Vulong Nguyen. Which is, you know, just take a look at the history behind Détente for the Ravenous, which is, you know, with Kevin's books, Before the Boats and They Took Our War, he borrowed a lot from the Ken Burns documentary about Vietnam, and I, you know, looked into the history behind that. So I guess I would probably do something similar, which is like, yeah, here's the history behind all of the horrible things that Henry Kissinger did, which would not be fun and would probably get demonetized on YouTube, but that's just how the cookie crumbles sometimes.
So what you're saying is it'd be kind of a bummer.
It would be kind of a bummer, I think. I read a lot of sad books for this before I wrote it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And do you have a title? Do you have a clickbaity title?
Oh, God. 5 coups the U.S. doesn't want you to know.
Honestly, would click.
Which is just probably like high school history for most of us in the United States.
Well, on that somewhat dour note.
Sorry.
No, you're good. It's great. I want to ask one more time, where can people find this game? Where can they find the novel? Because it's now, they're both out and in the world.
Yeah, if you just go to aaronsxl.itch.io, they'll show up. But if you want to throw a slash behind that, you can add aaronsxl.itch.io/DFTRRPG. You can get all of them and a starter adventure in a little bundle. So check that out if that sounds interesting.
So, Aaron, and I should have prepped you for this, and it's my fault I didn't, but I think you'll have a lot of answers for it. The question we ask everybody on the podcast to end an interview is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our way of asking for you to share a recommendation with our listeners. This could be in tabletop. It could be outside of tabletop. But what would you like to bring to the table today?
I want to shout out a fellow YouTuber by the name of Hassan Yangdi. I think they do like a really comprehensive series on SRDs. And they're constantly just talking about like SRDs that I've never heard of. The YouTube channel is called Hessens County. And they just have like a ton of really interesting work on like SRDs. 40 They have an SRD miniseries that is 40 videos long. I think no one out here is doing it like Hassan.
Whoa.
Highly recommend you check out their work, because it's like just really covering all the sorts of different systems that you can use to make your own games. So just like really, really fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Aaron, for coming to the table. I want to let people know where they can find you on the internet if they're looking for you.
Yeah, I'm at AA Voigt on YouTube, at AA Voigt on Blue Sky, Monster Factory fanfic on Tumblr. Don't worry about that one.
That one's going to be bolded in the show notes.
Aaron SXL on Twitter.
We will get those links in the show notes below. And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. We've got a lot of fun chats there. Come and join us. Those will both be linked in the show notes below. Rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what The Table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.